This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk.
Quitting drinking, whilst it was the most difficult thing I've ever done, has also been the single most rewarding because it changed everything and it gave me everything. It was all out there for the taking, but not whilst I was either shit-faced or ridiculously hungover day in, day out. So yeah, that really gave me the space to find out who I am, what I want to do, and then get busy doing it. I'd never have done that had I still been drinking.
Just a little snippet there from this week's guest on Over the Influence, Ali Press, who is a counsellor and coach from London. Ali is now 7 years alcohol-free, and to use Ali's own words, they were trapped in a repeating daily nightmare of their own making. Ali reached the end of the road with their drinking back in April 2017, and Ali knew that they had to get serious about quitting. It was that or die. So they set about working out what they needed to do. It's a fantastic chat. We loved having Ali join us on the podcast. Enjoy the episode.
Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
Hi, my name's Neil. I'm an OTI member. Most of my adult life, I've been sober curious or looking to go AF or doing stints of going alcohol free, but they would never stick. I think the reason they didn't stick was because there was lack of community or peer support. So once I found out about OTI in the community, I had to join straight away. Joining the OTI community has been the best alcohol-free decision I've ever made. It's such a fun, safe space to share your alcohol-free wins. There's always someone to give advice or celebrate with you. So if you're sober curious, come and join the fun at OTI. You won't regret it. It's a game changer.
You've heard the podcast. Now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to Over the Influence. It's ace to have you listening. My name is Sharon Hartley. I am based in Lancashire in the northwest of England. I'm 50. I used to drink too much, too quickly, too often. Just a quick recap. I took a break from alcohol back in the summer of 2018. And actually, as you're listening to this, I think I'm about a week away from being 6 years alcohol free. Flipping heck. I know, it's crazy. Honestly, it's ace. It's so, so good. And we thought, you know what? We need to talk about this more and we need to celebrate sobriety more. And that's why this podcast exists. I don't do it on my own, as you know. Ben Anderson, how are you?
Hi, fine, thanks. I'm Ben. I'm 36. I live in Liverpool. I gave up booze just over 4 years ago now. Didn't mean to, but best decision I ever made. And I'll tell you what, Shaz, we've had a great week, haven't we? The community's been absolutely buzzing this week.
It's
we've got
buzzing.
Loads of people getting started, loads of people hitting milestones, loads of people doing things that they never thought that they'd be able or confident enough to do. And it's just fabulous to see that so many people are really realising their full potential without booze. It's great. And I'm really excited to talk to today's guest because today's guest is 7 years alcohol free. And we've got lots of things to talk about, Chaz.
So 17 years of sobriety between us. It's not bad, that is it?
Not bad. Yes. Arms in the air.
Considering, well, I can only speak for myself where I was. that's a long, long time. Yeah, we're dead excited today. Chuffed to bits to welcome this week's guest to the podcast. Ali Press, who is from London. And Ali is a counsellor and coach. Ali, welcome to OTI. First question, dead simple. How the heck are you doing?
Oh, thank you. I'm really good, actually. I'm having a really nice August. I don't know if that's a weird thing to say, but the sun's shining. I've been outside with my courgettes and my tomatoes and all's good.
So when did you get your first pet courgette? Oh, so you're growing. Growing courgettes. I'd love to do that, you know. I'd absolutely love to do that. Sorry, go on, Shaz.
Get it on your list. Yeah, before we talk about sobriety, Ali, and what you do now and where you were as a drinker, can we just talk about your vegetables? Is that something that came came about in sobriety.
Yes, definitely. It did. And it's something that the whole sort of gardening thing is something that I find really relaxing. It's a good kind of mindfulness thing, because when I'm there and I'm looking at what I'm doing, I've got my fingers in the earth, I'm so present and I love it. And then I get to eat it as well. It's the best.
So good. So good. Do you have like a particular vegetable of choice, or one that you have more success with than others?
Oh, I'd usually say courgettes, but this year they've not been so good. So my obsession has moved slightly into cucumbers, which were growing wildly well in my greenhouse until I accidentally snipped off one of the main stems, and that sort of did for half my plant. But I like the variety. I've got some fruit out there, some vegetables, and yeah, it's the eating part that really gets me going.
So 8 years ago, Ali, do you think that you would have been able to relate to the person who says things like, I have an obsession with cucumbers? Or was that just so far removed?
No, that's a completely different me. When I look back at that me, it's like I don't recognise who I was, what I was doing. I'm baffled by a lot of it. But that was me. I lived it. I came out the other side. Yeah, so that me would be looking at me slightly oddly about the cucumbers and wondering where the beer was and what time the wine was coming on. Yeah.
Let's rewind then. Let's talk about the previous version of you. Maybe that's not the right way to say it, but drinker you, Ali, yeah. Before you know, decided to make a massive change and became who you are today. Let's rewind and tell us a bit more about you.
Sure. Gosh, where to start? I mean, I started drinking as a teen, really, when I was still in high school. And, you know, it was a bit fun. It was a bit naughty, but it also started to get a bit out of hand quite quickly, which was horrible, really. And that sort of continued right through till I was shortly before my 41st birthday. So better part of 27 years I spent drinking industrial quantities of alcohol. And yeah, it was hard work, really.
In what way?
Because, but dedication is kind of the wrong word, but it takes a certain amount of dedication to keep doing that to yourself day in, day out. The sort of the resilience to get through feeling like utter crap every single day of the week and then continuing to do it, because you've got the compulsion that's going, go on, have a drink, have a drink, have a drink. And you've got the part of you that's going, no, this is horrendous. I cannot do this any longer, competing with one another. And it's nearly always the booze that would win out. So nothing changed. And I was trapped in this repeating daily torture of my own making. That's what was probably so awful about it. That sort of knowledge towards the end that I was doing this repeatedly to myself, to my detriment, and felt utterly trapped there.
Mm. And when you say then, you know, it happened quite quickly, like how quick were we talking here? Like, when did you realise that actually you and drinking maybe wasn't a great mix?
Oh, I mean, I remember being with some friends. I was possibly around 17. I might have just turned 18. It was before I went to university. And we were hanging out, having some drinks. And this girl said to me that she thought that my drinking was way over the top. And I was like, panic, massive denial. Up went the kind of the defense shutters and so on. So 17, 18. And then when I went to university, being completely on my own. Yes, of course, there were loads of people around, but no sort of guidance around me trying to find my way in the world, and booze becoming more of a thing to kind of lower my inhibitions, to take away some of the excruciating shyness that I felt as a way to try and make friends with people. And I guess it was maybe, well, it wasn't very far into that where I was spending a fair amount of time on my own drinking. And I was probably 19, 20 when another friend to me said to me that they thought I might be an alcoholic, which of course was again one of the don't say those words to me kind of thing. So, yeah, 4 or 5 years after I started, I guess.
How did that feel at the age of 19, having somebody suggest that you might be an alcoholic? Because it's a word that we talk about on the podcast a lot within our community. Some people use it, some people don't. Some people find the term alcoholic incredibly useful to keep them sober. I've got friends that are proud of that term. And how did that feel at a young age for somebody else to suggest, oh, you might be alcoholic?
I was horrified. It's kind of a lot of those similar feelings about if somebody would say to me later on in life that I think you're an alcoholic. It was like the not me thing. What even is an alcoholic? And that kind of feeds into lots of the debates about why people do use or don't use or like or don't like the word. But it's this idea that I was somehow really broken, really unsavable, really, that I was kind of, I'd crossed a line off into some other place, some other, like other being the main thing around it, where, yeah, I was going to be forever dogged with this thing kind of following me around. And yeah, I was horrified by that. That's not something that I wanted to be. Yet at the same time, I could also recognize in me that kind of compulsion part of it was already there. And I liked drinking. I liked the effects that it was having on me. But the idea that I might be an alcoholic, that was, yeah, not something that I really wanted to entertain.
It makes me sad to hear you say that you felt unsavable. Mm-hmm. It's a really bleak way of looking at it, isn't it? That anybody could be unsavable.
Totally. There I was in my early 20s thinking that I'd like, can I swear? Is that okay?
You can fill your boots. Can.
Great. That I'd fucked up so massively. I know, Ben. Shush. Yeah, that I'd fucked up so massively already by that point that the rest of my life was going to be, I don't know. I don't know what, because I wasn't really thinking beyond when could I have my next drinking session or whatever it was I was doing. But it is awful. And the truth is that nobody is unsavable. It's not a thing. With the right support, the right circumstances, people can really change a lot of stuff. Change is always possible.
Ali, can we talk about then that 20 years? So you're talking there about your early 20s. You gave up alcohol in your early 40s. Mm. There's 20 years there where, yeah, you know, you lived a pretty successful life. You know, you've told us that you were a lecturer in higher education. You don't get to do that kind of job if you're not respected and hardworking. And, you know, did your, you know, did booze hold you back professionally or in any other way? Because it's, you know, when you say to someone, oh, I did that for X amount of years, it's an impressive thing to say to someone.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is. I managed to achieve an awful lot whilst at the same time maintaining a massive booze problem.
Another layer to always being knackered.
Yeah, totally, totally. Yeah. And always feeling like crap. And then turning up to work in the morning, feeling like I probably stink like last night's booze because it's all coming out of my pores, and never really feeling comfortable until lunchtime when I could plausibly have been to the pub with some colleagues. And that's why I stink of booze, not because I'm still like carrying it from the night before. Yeah, it's a really interesting sort of way to think about it, that I still managed to achieve all of the things that I did whilst at the same time drinking like I was. I'm not going to say it was easy, but in some ways, doing higher education, doing a degree, master's degree, stuff like that, that was part of my plan to keep me off the booze, because how could I possibly drink like that if I'm then also studying to do this? What I learned was that it was entirely possible, and I could carry on drinking like I was and then do all the work at the end whilst crying, which nobody really benefits well from. And I guess what it's bringing up for me is this idea around being a high-functioning problematic drinker or alcoholic or whatever your kind of word is. And I think that's actually kind of common. People are able to balance both in a way that they can achieve, they can do, they can hold down jobs like I was doing. But then at the same time, disappearing into this massive pit of shame once the workday had ended, staying in the shame and then coming into work the next day, still feeling really ashamed. It's again, it was one of those things where I look back on old me and I'm slightly baffled about how that was even possible. I know it was because I did it, I lived it. But yeah, so senseless in lots of ways.
But you don't see it, do you, until you step out of it. Ben describes it on occasion as like unplugging from the matrix. Yeah. I didn't realise how problematic my drinking had become until I stopped.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like looking back in the rearview mirror and you're like, God, I functioned at like 70% most days. And you're thinking, that's normal. And yet we continue, don't we?
Mm-hmm. The effort you've got to put in is 130%. Because exactly what you're trying to appear like, I feel fine. There's nothing wrong. Yeah. No, I didn't stay up too late last night. Yeah. You're feeling 70, you're having to put in 130, and all that's doing is just wearing you down and down and down and down, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. It's just like trying to maintain this facade of, no, nothing to see here, nothing going on, it's all fine. But, you're working at 70, putting in 130 or more, and absolutely exhausted. And actually, when I stopped drinking, me and my then partner, we went for a dinner party at some neighbours just down the road. She was still drinking, and I got a kind of a glimpse of what it must have been like to have us both drinking as dinner guests. And I was horrified. I really was. And I couldn't show that to my partner, and I couldn't show that in front of the people that I was with. But it kind of compounded that shame of, what was I thinking? I've been behaving like this for so many years now. What is that all about? But yeah, like you say, you often don't know what you're doing until you're out of it. And then you look back and you're like, oh, that's not good.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit more about the shame? Mm. In terms of the feelings, because we have people in our community that are in the really early days, first few weeks, first few months, and it is a word that comes up a lot, and it can be a lot to deal with, can't it? Especially in those early days when you stopped, and then all these weird feelings, and then you've got to start sitting with the feelings, as it's called, and it's a word that just comes up again and again and again. You're now 7 years alcohol-free. Has that changed for you over that time, Ali?
Yeah, totally. My shame was off the scale. Crippling shame is probably how I describe it now. And I could look back on all of that and all of that drinking, all of that wasted time, all of the bad decisions, all that kind of thing, and feel really regretful. I could just continue to beat myself up day in, day out, day in, day out. But that doesn't help. That doesn't serve me, and it doesn't serve anybody else. So one of the things that was really important for me was accepting that me and actually having some compassion for that me, looking back at that me and going, yeah, okay, those weren't some of the best decisions that you've made. That's not some of the best stuff you've done. But you were really trying your hardest. And it sounds really bizarre to look at drinking like that as trying your best. But there's this certain wisdom in that resistance, because a lot of my drinking was around not wanting to deal with some really uncomfortable emotions, some feelings, people pleasing, all sorts of stuff. And drinking was almost a way of keeping myself safe from that stuff, because I had all this clanging discordance going on in my head, all these things that I knew that were wrong. And by having a drink, I could just kind of turn the volume down on all of that kind of stuff. So totally maladaptive as far as coping mechanisms go. But all I can do now is look back on that me and, yeah, okay, I feel kind of sorry for myself. I feel not in like I'm a victim kind of way, but more of an empathy sort of thing, where I look back and I think, yeah, you were trying. You were trying really hard. Come on. Give me a hug kind of thing. And that I found was really, important in letting go of that shame. And I, there's a second point to that, and it's really interesting and important, I think, that you mentioned that your community members are talking about this and talking about their shame. For me, finding community, other people who'd been to similar places that I had in terms of drinking, similar types of behaviours, and realising that I wasn't on my own.
Ali, I'm not sure if you know this about me and Sharon, but we're not just podcasters, we are supposedly radio professionals. So I'm going to do a really slick segue here. Sharon, I think you'll appreciate this.
Go on.
Speaking of our community, one of the things, the newest thing that has been launched in our community is a group, and what's it called? AF and Neurodivergent? Is that what you search for, Shaz? The reason it's a slick segue, Ali, is because in your email to us, you talk about some of the suggested topics that we could talk about. And one of those is discovering my neurodivergence. Can we talk about that? Can we talk about what your neurodivergence is and how it was discovered?
Yeah, so I have a small collection, dyspraxia, ADHD and autism, all of which I discovered after I'd quit drinking. One of the, I guess, the key things around that was, as I'd quit and I'd gone a few months, and I was looking to the group that I was in, Club Soda, for support. And there were people there who'd quit years ago. They were doing well, thriving, talking about all these amazing benefits and so on. And I was comparing myself to them as sort of my point in my journey. And I was thinking, well, when do I get that boost in brain power? When do I get to be able to socialize like a pro without a drink in my hand? When do I get these things? And it wasn't until I was looking at working with a personal trainer and explaining to them about the dyspraxia, because I'd actually had a layperson's diagnosis of dyspraxia from an ex-girlfriend in Sainsbury's car park once after I walked into a line of trolleys. It had been in the back of my mind, but as I looked into it more, I discovered about the cognitive side of dyspraxia, which is also called DCD, or developmental coordination disorder now, and things like the brain fogginess, the poor memory, difficulty concentrating, those kinds of things. I was like, oh, there's something in there. Maybe there's more to this than I'd previously thought. So I went along down that pathway, and I had an assessment and a diagnosis. And I was talking to the occupational therapist about it. And one of the things that she was saying is this kind of correlation between problematic use of substances, whether that's alcohol or drugs or whatever, and undiagnosed neurodivergence. I was like, oh, yeah, this makes quite a lot of sense. But what I found was that those answers that I got through that assessment didn't really fully encompass my experience, and I started to look at other things that might be going on. ADHD was the next one, as I kind of had this idea that it might be possible for me. But also, I wasn't really fully aware of the range of kind of symptoms and presentations of ADHD, particularly for people assigned female at birth, because a lot of the things around hyperactivity, a lot of the diagnoses is around boys, AMAB people, and that kind of different presentation where it's more outward, whereas a AFAB person's experience can often be more inward because of those different kinds of socialization.
Can I stop you for a second, Ali? Just what do you mean by AFAB?
Sure, AFAB is assigned female at birth. I'm a non-binary person who was assigned female at birth, and the other one of those is assigned male at birth. So that's AFAB. And I like that it has fab in it. It's my fab.
Yes, me too.
So I went off down that route, and it was a really long process, because there was at least sort of 18 months, 2 years after I had an initial conversation with a nurse before I actually got to speak to a psychiatrist. And that was after being referred by my GP, which then, you know, also added to that time thing. I went through that, and I was like, yeah, this makes a lot more sense. This kind of explains a lot more of my experience, but it still doesn't really encompass all the other things that I think are going on with me. And I had this little birdie in the back of my mind saying, possibly autism. But again, I thought, no, not me, because a lot of the research around autism and a lot of the sort of the stereotypes around it are also about boys, men, adolescent boys and so on. And this didn't seem to fit me. But the more I looked into it, the more it started to seem like actually this is me. It's just not that kind of presentation. And the thing with neurodivergence generally is that it's not easy to put people into neat little boxes, because there's a lot of crossover between all the kind of different neurodivergent conditions, and how my neurodivergence presents won't be the same as yours or somebody else's. So it's very common now for people to talk about my ADHD or my autism. It's partly as a way of owning it, but also partly as a way of explaining the differences, I guess, between us all, because we are all very unique.
What was that like, getting the diagnosis?
It answered a lot of questions, and it gave me a lot of relief. It gave, like, particularly around autism, because I'd wondered for a long time. Like, I'd used booze as a kind of a social lubricant, because it was kind of good at that. But without that, the social awkwardness was just there all of the time. But once I had a reason for that, I was like, okay. It's not that there's something wrong with me, because there isn't. I'm just wired differently. So that was a big relief, but it also gave me other avenues to explore, things to try. I ended up having some coaching around ADHD and managing executive function. So it was a little bit like being given some keys, and like they would unlock different parts of my brain, and I could get them to function better, and I could understand more about me, how I am, why I am. And actually, that's all okay. There's nothing wrong with me.
Yeah. Ali, we spoke to John Waite on the podcast a couple of weeks ago now. He's a celeb baker, Strictly Come Dancing. He's done all sorts of stuff. It's all round sober superstar. And he was diagnosed with ADHD, I think it was possibly last year. There's somebody watching this now from our community who is going through something very similar. And she just commented there, oh my goodness, yes, that's just how it's been for me. And it's something that comes up in the community, on the podcast with our guests, time and time again. People remove the alcohol, and then further down the line, be it months, years, in a lot of cases, you know, we're talking years, they uncover neurodiversity, and it all sort of starts to make sense.
And that's one of the, I was going to say fulfilling, one of the most fulfilling parts of now having this new knowledge about myself, because I can look back on things and I can look at things in the here and now, and I'm like, yeah, that'd be neurodivergence, and I'm like, yeah, that's okay. I don't know, I just have like a sort of a warm inner glow at the moment, because all of those past experiences and things, they start to make a lot more sense to me about why things went the way they did, what happened with me in all of that kind of thing. It's a relief.
Ali, it has been, there's been a lot going on, hasn't there? You know, in terms of speaking of that person that you were and not being able, it makes sense now when you say that you can't necessarily recognise the person that you were before. We've had a question just come in from Angie's watching. Could I ask how long Ali has been aware / diagnosed with ADHD / ASD, and also how long has it taken you to feel, you know, positive about it, where you are now with it,
to feel good about those things? So ADHD, I first was put on medication 2 summers ago. So it's probably 5 years now since I went down the referral pathway with my GP. Feeling good about it, That took longer because I was in a job role where neurodivergence wasn't supported very well at all, in spite of there being lots of messaging around inclusivity and everybody is welcome, whatever they're bringing, la, la, la. But apart from that, wasn't true from my view of it on the inside. And it actually took getting out of that environment where, to me, it felt punitive. It was a very punitive way of dealing with difference that absolutely didn't work for me. And once I was out of that environment, I was able to take a bit more stock about it. And I'm like, yeah. And feeling good about ADHD. I know that it has, there are superpowers that come with it, but there are things I also find intensely irritating. It's like, if I'm writing something and I'm constructing a sentence, it's there in front of me, I'm typing away, I'm thinking about it, and then words from the sentence will start to kind of fade out of my mind as I'm going along. And I know that's the neurodivergence. I know that's the inattentive part of my ADHD, but it doesn't make it any less frustrating because I can't grab them and put them back. It's like when they're gone, they're gone. So I have a sentence with a hole in it, and I know that before too long, the entire sentence will evaporate. But there are other good things about it, like the hyper-focus type aspects.
I was going to say that because it's so much of neurodivergence, I think, the conversation can focus around the challenging things to do with it. It can very much the narrative is the things that are difficult as a result of the diagnosis. Tell us about the superpowers. That's what I'm interested in.
Yeah. Superpowers, like the hyper focus part of things. Once I get into something, I can be really, really into it. There can be quite a sort of a step or a jump to get into something because I have to like ditch hours and hours of procrastination to get stuck into something. But when I do, I can be really, really focused about it. And another thing I think is my ability to let go of things, which helps a lot in terms of emotional intelligence. So if I get upset about something or I'm annoyed about something, if I can change what I'm doing, go do something else, whatever it was that happened over here just kind of like just disappears off by itself. My perspective on it changes quite quickly, and I'm not one to hold on to things. And that is largely because I can't. Once they've happened, they've gone, and I've kind of moved on. A bit of processing happens. And I guess that's one of the things that I find quite rewarding, I guess, about having ADHD.
Just so you know, community members who are watching, there's currently hearts going across their Zoom screens, which I think is hearts of approval, Ali.
I hope so.
I'm sure
yeah.
they yes.
Yeah.
Not just that someone's pressed the wrong button on their Zoom screen. I think it was intentional. Yeah. No, I find that really interesting because I do think that society, we are becoming more understanding. We are becoming more, I mean, I was even going to say accepting of difference. I think it needs to go a step further for me. And it is about, you know, it is recognizing and utilizing difference in society. I think that's the step that we need to take next. I think, you know, we talk about diversity and inclusion all the time. For me, it's the word representation is missing from that as well. I do feel like diversity and inclusion can still signal difference in a way. You know, we are diverse. We are we must include every, but that shows that we are excluding. I don't want to go off on it too much because you will get me on my soapbox and I will be talking about this for ages. And I'm coming at this, Ali, from the point of view of I've got a son with Down syndrome. You know, it's there's so many things that I think what you're talking about in terms of neurodivergence, there's definitely positives that we can see with that as well. You know, it's not all positive. There's some really difficult things, some really challenging things. There's a lot of things that, you know, wreck your head a bit. You know, he's not two yet. So he's young and we're still not quite sure exactly how it's going to affect him as he grows up. But I think, you know, for me, it's, I don't know. I think I look at society and I really like that there are positive steps towards being more, again, I come back to that word, accept it. To get wrong, go with this. It feels like we've taken some really good steps forward. There are actually a few more steps forward that we need to take. And yeah. That exactly what you said, it's not just about the, you know, making things easier for people who've got, you know, different neurodivergences because of this and this can affect here. It's about actually completely flipping it and going, right, and you know what? There are superpowers. And I wish that we did that more as a society. I wish we talked about the positives as well as the challenging things.
Yeah.
I said I wasn't going to get on my soapbox. I lied. There we go.
I'm going to climb up next to you onto the soapbox because the thing that sort of bugs me around the inclusion and diversity sorts of agendas is that I am more than neurodivergent. That is just one thing about me. There's a whole bunch of other things that kind of can be ignored if I'm treated as the neurodivergent one. And okay, it can make my life better in some ways for someone to go, okay, neurodivergent, what do you need? And I can go, these things, and then it happens.
Of course.
But that's also one of the least interesting things about me. I have superpowers. I'm able to do a whole bunch of other things. Please stop making me all about neurodivergence or making things all about that.
You've accidentally touched on one of our all-time favourite quotes here at Over the Influence,
just a little giggle then, and he's going to explain why.
Go on, we've got a fabulous community member who's also a counsellor, like you, actually. Yeah. She's fabulously intelligent. And just on one of these Zoom calls, she just has this way of just summing up, you know, an hour-long conversation in the perfect sentence. And she went, look, you know, for me, giving up alcohol, it's one of the least interesting things about me. I was like, yes, that's what we're doing here. You know, we're removing alcohol. And at the beginning, you got to focus on it and you got to think about it. You got to plan the events and da, da, da. But actually, the aim of Over the Influence, what we want to do here is to help people to become happy, confident, non-drinkers and actually not think about it. It's just, it becomes one of the least interesting things about them. Oh, Ali, I tell you what, it's lovely to meet you. You just got our vibe all over.
Right up our street.
Thoroughly enjoying this.
I've got my eye on the clock and I've realised we get carried away and then before we know, we're like, oh, crikey, we're out of time, we want to wrap up. But we've got another 10 minutes or so. And what I'd like to touch on next is your move from your academic career into counselling in coaching. And what was that like? I mean, I realise we've jumped all over the show here and we've probably missed out like a huge chunk of your own personal journey. But it has been, as you said in your email to us, like the hardest thing you've done and this real, and it's a bit of a cliche, but we like cliches, this journey of self-discovery and finding out exactly who you are.
Yeah.
So fast forward to present day and Ali as the counsellor and the coach. Tell us about that and what that change has been like for you.
It's been massive. I was just looking at my other screen because like when I booked this interview a while ago, you sent me four questions and one of them was, how has your life changed? In every way imaginable, including around what I do. I didn't find my previous career all that fulfilling. I had a lot of imposter syndrome going on. I had all the shame from the drinking and so on. And I probably quit over 18 months before I actually left that role. And it was always there in the back of my mind. Be a counsellor. Even if I look back to when I was 16 year old me wanted to go into psychology and do a degree in psychology. But that wasn't a possibility. It was engineering or some kind of science or white collar kind of like suit and tie type roles. I mean, I possibly wouldn't have worn a suit and tie, but do you know what I mean? Those kind of roles. So it was never a possibility for me, even though it was there in the background. And once I'd done sort of a year, couple of years, probably more like three into my quitting journey, I'd amassed a huge amount of experience around actually quitting, staying quit, and everything that entails, plus supporting other people in our community that were also coming through and wanting to do similar things. But also I'd had to start unpicking a whole load of stuff that happened in my life and come to terms with things that I had previously been drinking to numb out. And it just started to seem more and more like something that I really wanted to do. And part of it, part of the work that I was doing around supporting other people changing their drinking was about, if I could save somebody in this community an ounce of the pain and the shit that I went through, I'll do it. Have it. You can have more, all of my information, all of my knowledge. But I wanted to sort of formalize that in some way. So coming out of the role that I was in meant that I had space to do some further training. So I did all of my higher education on top of full-time working, which was quite a lot to do. And then I found myself with time where I could actually do a daytime course. I knew I was going to have to do a clinical placement and so on. And it's just been something that had been like twittering away in the back of my mind. I was like, yep, yeah, no, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do something about this. And yeah, the training was brilliant and awful and really like shoving myself through a grinder sometimes, particularly when we look at like child development type stuff as applied to me. But yeah, it's been one of the best things that I've done. When I say best things that I've done since I quit drinking, there's loads of them, because if we go back to that question, how has your life changed in almost every single way possible? That's been one of the most rewarding, I think, being able to retrain in a way that really speaks to who I am and what I want to do and how I want to be in the world in a way that I can give back to people like me. I needed a me when I was younger. That me needed this me, but this me wasn't around. So I can be this me for other people.
That's really lovely, Ali. And it's... you know, going full circle now, coming back to what you were saying earlier about how, you know, that mental strain, that kind of constant argument, that huge amount of energy that you were putting towards drinking and then being fine the next day and then the battle going on in your head constantly. And
pretending,
you know, the fact that
I was fine then. Yeah, pretending I was fine.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, what you've done since removing alcohol is that you've had the time and the energy to really reflect on who you are, what's important to you, and what you want to contribute to the world. And I think that's fabulous to hear that, because actually you know, would you have been able to make that career change? Would you have been able to have those same kind of realizations and those discoveries if it hadn't have been for removing alcohol? Sounds like, you know, probably not.
Absolutely not. No. I mean, quitting drinking, whilst it was the most difficult thing I've ever done, has also been the single most rewarding, because it changed everything and it gave me everything. It was all out there for the taking, but not whilst I was either shit-faced or ridiculously hungover day in, day out. So yeah, that really gave me the space to find out who I am, what I want to do, and then get busy doing it. I'd never have done that had I still been drinking.
Amazing.
I love that. That's just brilliant. I mean, what a fantastic way to end the episode. Ali, it has been an absolute joy to chat. Thank you so much for your time. Before you go, if anybody wants to get in touch with you with regards to your counselling services, where can they find your information?
So I have a website, alipress.uk. That's where you'll find info about what I do and how I do it. Or my email address is ali@alipress.uk, and then that will just pop straight into my inbox and I'm happy to have a chat.
Amazing. Thanks for sharing, Ali. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me as well. That's awesome. Thank you.